night
that
we
recorded was like
things.
The single funniest night of the entire summer.
Yeah,
what's
that
was a great
night.
The night that we
recorded.
Happened to be recording.
That
oh,
was a great night
the,
to record.
The can of worms thing?
Yeah.
Oh my gosh, that was so much fun.
Dude, Steve's here too.
That was the best.
I like
Steve.
Like,
did they drive together?
No, they didn't.
What's up, Lauren?
Hi.
Hi, darling.
Hey.
Hi.
Give generously to everybody that comes to you. And God, we confess that we lack wisdom and that you have lots of wisdom. And so we ask that you would speak wisdom to us, whether you're speaking directly, whether you're speaking through Lewis and through this book. God, whether you speak through me and for everybody else here. God, we confess our need for you, and we confess our desire to see you and to have your wisdom. So we ask that you would share it with us. We ask that you would show us your generosity. In Christ's name, amen.
Amen.
Amen. So thank you guys for coming. It's really, really great to have all you guys here. I think what we'll do today is I think we'll go through the preface, because the preface is actually quite excellent. And then maybe what we'll do is we'll pause after the preface, take any comments, questions, and then go to the first chapter. I think we can skip the foreword. If you want to read that on your own, you can. It's really cool. I think the basic story of this book, I think most of you guys probably know some of, but what this book is actually a series of talks that C.S. Lewis gave on the BBC radio in England during World War II, when England was having the crap bombed out of it. Just as a country, they kind of realized, we don't really have the moral resources to deal with what's going on. We know we have Christianity, but most of us don't really know what it is anymore. By that point, the nation had already become, you know, fairly secularized, but it hadn't really been replaced with anything else, and so there wasn't, as far as a time when you needed something to stand on to have fortitude, they just realized there wasn't much left that they were standing on. And so the BBC, so like the government's official radio thing, goes and hires C.S. Lewis to represent Christianity to Britain, and then, you know, through that to the rest of the British Empire, who's trying to undergo this Nazi bombing, and to try to, you know, kind of represent the faith to everybody. And then this is basically what it is. So it's slightly expanded, but for the most part, these are just the talks that were delivered. I think it was 1942 that they were felt, but it says it all in here. So what we can do is we can go through the preface, and we can go around and have different people kind of read a paragraph and just go from person to person. If we do that, my main request is that whoever reads really freaking loud so everybody can hear. So we need like a strong, powerful reading voice.
This girl.
I mean, anybody can do it. I believe anybody has the potential for strong powerfulness, but bring the heat for us. Don't give me any weak
stuff. Yeah, Steve will yell.
So what we'll do is maybe kind of comments and questions we'll keep to the end of the chapter. But if there's any clarifying things, like if Lewis uses a word and you don't understand it, just throw your hand up real quick and we'll pause and explain that thing. So hey, man.
Certainly. The coolies.
No worries, we're late too. So like I said, if there's any questions on stuff. If it's a clarifying thing, like it's not going to make sense unless we explain this word, throw your hand up really quick so that we can understand it. If not, if it's just like this is a thought that came to me, then we'll get to it when we finish the preface.
Cool.
Who would like to be number one? Who wants to be numero uno?
I'll be number one.
All right, we got number one right here.
The best.
So this is powerful, strong reading voice.
The contents of this book were first given on the air and then published in three separate parts as Broadcast Talks, 1942, Christian Behavior, 1943, and Beyond Personality, 1944. In the printed versions, I made a few additions to what I had said at the microphone, but otherwise left the text much as it had been. A talk on the radio should, I think, be as like real talk as possible and should not sound like an essay being read aloud. In my talks, I had therefore used all the contractions and colloquialisms I ordinarily use in conversation. In the printed version, I reproduced this, putting don't and we for do not and we have. and wherever in the talks I had made the importance of a word clear by the emphasis of my voice, I printed it in italics. I am now inclined to think that this was a mistake, an undesirable hybrid between the art of speaking and the art of writing. A talker ought to use variations of voice for emphasis because his medium naturally lends itself to that method. But a writer ought not to use italics for the same purpose. He has his own different means of bringing out the key words and ought to use them. In this edition, I have expanded the contractions and replaced most of the italics by a recasting of the sentences in which they occurred, but without altering, I hope, the popular or familiar tone which I had all along intended. I have also added and deleted where I thought I understood any part of my subject better now than 10 years ago, or where I knew that the original version had been misunderstood by others.
Excellent.
That was
nice.
Beautiful.
It was nice. Lauren?
Yeah.
Go for it.
Go for it.
Nope.
The reader should be warned that I offer no help to anyone who is hesitating between two Christian denominations. You will not learn from me whether you ought to become an Anglican, a Methodist, or a Presbyterian, or a Roman Catholic. This omission is intentional. Even in the list I have just given, the order is alphabetical. There is no mystery about my own position. I am a very ordinary layman of the Church of England, not especially high or especially low or especially anything else. But in this book, I am not trying to convert anyone to my own position. Ever since I became a Christian, I have thought that the best, perhaps the only, service I should do for my unbelieving neighbors was to explain and defend the belief that has been common to nearly all Christians at the time. I had more than one reason for thinking this. In the first place, the questions which divide Christians from one another often involve points of high theology or even ecclesiastical history, which ought never to be treated except by real experts. I should have been out of my depth in such waters, more in need of help myself than able to help others. And secondly, I think we must admit that the discussion of these disputed points has no tendency at all to bring an outsider into the Christian fold. So long as we write and talk about them, we are much more likely to deter him from entering any Christian communion than to draw him into our own. Our division should never be discussed except in the presence of those who have already come to believe that there is one God and that Jesus Christ is his holy Son. Finally, I got the impression that far more and more talented authors were already engaged in such controversial matters than in the defense of what Baxter calls mere Christianity. That part of the line where I thought I could serve best was also the part that seemed to be the thinnest, and to it I naturally went.
Thank you.
So far as I know, these were my only motives, and I should be very glad if people would not draw fanciful inferences from my silence on certain disputed matters. For example, such silence need not mean that I myself am sitting on the fence. Sometimes I am. There are questions at issue between Christians to which I do not think we have been told the answer. There are some to which I may never know the answer. If I ask them, then even in a better world, I might, for all I know, be answered as the far greater question was answered. What is that to be? Follow thou me. But there are other questions as to which I am definitely on one side of the fence, and yet say nothing. For I am not writing to expound something I could call my religion, but to expound mere Christianity, which is what it is and what it is long before I was born and whether I like it or not.
What is your name?
Me?
Yeah.
Amy.
Amy. Do you want to read next?
Yeah, sure. You're welcome.
Some people draw unwarranted conclusions from the fact that I never say more about the Blessed Virgin Mary than is involving in asserting the virgin birth of Christ. But surely my reason for not doing so is obvious. To say more would take me at once into highly controversial regions, and there is no controversy between Christians which needs to be so delicately touched at this. The Roman Catholic beliefs on this subject are to held not only to the ordinary fervor that attaches to all sincere religious beliefs, but very naturally, with the peculiar is, as it were, chivalrous sensibility that a man feels when the honor of his mother or beloved is at stake. It is very difficult so to dissent from them that you will not appear to them as cad as well as heretic. What is cad?
I don't know what a cad is.
You don't? Okay.
I think it's a jerk.
It's like a
fraud.
Well, heretic is like somebody
speaking
like cad is
like a house cad.
Okay, so St. Luke says that a cad is a fraud, and then a heretic is somebody who is like departing from the Christian faith. So
that's
what
that says.
Man who behaves dishonorably.
Look at that. A man who behaves dishonorably.
No, I don't. For a split second there, I really thought that was the
same thing. Oh, St.
Yeah, exactly. Sorry, keep going.
No, that's okay. And contrariwise, the opposed Protestants believe on this subject calls forth feelings which go down to the very roots of the monotheism, whatever. To radical Protestants, it seems that the distinction between creator and creature, however holy, is imperiled, that polytheism is risen again. Hence it is heard so to dissent from them that you will not appear something worse than a heretic, a pagan. If any topic could be replied upon to wreck the book of mere Christianity, if any topic makes utterly unprofitable reading for those who do not yet believe that the Virgin Son is God, surely this is it. Yeah.
Yeah. Were there terms there that didn't make sense?
I just want to, like,
kind of
lost.
Got a bit lost. Yeah. Which big words are not clear?
I think it's the combination of big words.
So monotheism. Do you guys know what that one is? So
is
monotheism. So yeah. So you can use your Greek here. So monos, one, theos, God. Monotheism. There you go. Polytheism.
Many gods.
Exactly. So you have polus.
Poly gods.
Yeah. Polus, many, theos, gods. Many gods. So. Does that make sense? Okay. Are there any other terms that are there which are like aren't immediately clear?
So is he just saying that?
We can come.
What
back.
Is he? Okay.
Yeah, we can come back to this too.
Okay.
But yeah, we can totally come back to this. But just briefly, so that we can keep going through the section. What he's saying is that for, like you know, from a Roman Catholic perspective, to have a correct position towards the Virgin Mary is like really integral to the faith. And so there's a sense in which if you have an incorrect position towards her, then it's like it's almost like it's a different faith altogether. Whereas from a lot of Protestant positions, not all, but a lot of them, it seems as though the Virgin Mary is held up so highly, almost like she's another god in addition to God. And so that seems like that's actually polytheism or like paganism or some kind. Does that make sense? And so he's saying the whole thing is, it's so, like, there's such strong feelings on like, a number of different sides, and there's so many different positions, that to say anything on that particular topic is just, it's quite difficult. And so he ends up remaining silent for most of the rest of the book on it. Yeah. Does that make sense? Okay. Cool.
Am I reading now? I don't have a copy of the book, so... Are we just doing a paragraph?
Yes, we're doing a paragraph.
Oddly enough, you cannot even conclude from my silence on disputed points, either that I think them important or that I think them unimportant. For this is itself one of the disputed points. One of the things Christians are agreed about, is the importance of their disagreements. When two Christians of different denominations start arguing, it is usually not long before one asks whether such and such a point really matters, and the other replies, matter? Why, it's absolutely essential. All this is said simply in order to make clear what kind of book I was trying to write, not in the least to conceal or evade responsibility for my own beliefs. About those, as I said before, there is no secret. To quote Uncle Toby, there are written in the Common Prayer Book,
that I should put forward as common Christianity anything that was peculiar to the Church of England or worse to myself. I tried to guard against this by sending the original script of what is now Book 2 to four clergymen, American, Methodist...
Anglican?
What?
Anglican?
Oh, I didn't. Oh. Just went over that one.
I love the USA.
America.
Presbyterian and Roman Catholic. And asking for their criticism. The Methodist thought I had not said enough about faith, and the Roman Catholic thought I had gone rather too far about the comparative unimportance of theories and explanation of the atonement. Otherwise, all five of us were agreed. I did not have the remaining books similarly vetted because in them, though differences might arise among Christians, these would be differences between individuals or schools of thought, not between denominations.
Great, thank you.
Welcome.
So far, as I can judge from reviews and from the numerous letters written to me, the book, however faulty in other respects, did at least succeed in presenting an agreed or common or central or mere Christianity. In that way, it may possibly be some of the help, maybe of some help in silencing the view that if we omit the disputed points, we shall have left only a vague and bloodless HCF. The HCF turns out to be something not only positively but pungent, divided from all non-Christian beliefs by a chasm to which the worst divisions inside Christendom are not really comparable at all. If I have not directly helped the cause of reunion, I have perhaps made it clear why we ought to be reunited. Certainly, I have met with little of the fabled odium theologicum from convinced members of communions different from my own. Hostility has come more from borderline people, whether within the Church of England or without it. Men not exactly obedient to any communion. This I find curiously consoling. It is at her center where her truest children dwell that each communion is really closest to every other spirit, other in spirit, if not in doctrine. And this suggests that at the center of each there is something or someone who against all divergences of belief, all differences of temperament, all memories of mutual persecution speak with the same voice.
Great. Thank you. By the way, I have no idea what HDF is.
Me neither.
I apologize for that. I have no idea what it is. Odium theologicum would be theological hatred.
That's pretty mundane.
What was he saying in that paragraph?
What was he saying?
Yeah.
What he's saying is that there is some fear that if you get down to what is mere Christianity, so what is held in common by everybody who's going to call themselves a Christian, there is a fear that what you're going to have is just going to be sort of a lame mishmash of nothingness, that there's not actually much that is held in common. And he's saying that he's actually found the opposite to be the case, that in getting to the core beliefs, he's found that they really have been, like, the book was embraced by everybody that came across it, and the only people that didn't really embrace it were those who didn't really identify with it a whole lot. And so those who really identified themselves as Christians strongly, no matter which denomination they were from, really appreciated what he was doing. And it was those who were kind of on the borderline as to whether or not they care about the stuff or don't care about it. Those are the ones who,
got it.
Who had problems with it.
Got it. Thank
yeah.
you.
What's that? Yeah, that could be it. I was thinking like lowest common denominator, but yeah, Hispanic college. The vague and bloodless Hispanic college. That's what Bo is known for. Thank you, Steve.
Genius. So much for my omissions on doctrine in book three, which deals with morals. I have also passed over some things in silence, but for a different reason. Ever since I served as an infantryman in the First World War, I have had a great dislike of people who themselves in ease and safety issue exhortations to men in the front lines. As a result, I have a reluctance to say much about temptations to which I myself am not exposed. No man, I suppose, is tempted to every sin. It so happens that the impulse which makes men gamble has been left out of my makeup, and no doubt I pay for this by lacking some good impulse of which it is the excess or perversion. I therefore did not feel myself qualified to give advice about permissible and impermissible gambling. If there is any permissible, for I do not claim to know even that. I have also said nothing about birth control. I am not a woman, nor even a married man, nor am I a priest. I did not think it my place to take a firm line about pains, dangers, and expenses from which I am protected, having no pastoral office which obliged me to do so.
Far deeper objections may be felt and have been expressed against my use of the word Christian to mean one who accepts the common doctrines of Christianity. People ask, who are you to lay down who is and who is not a Christian? Or may not many a man who cannot believe these doctrines be far more truly a Christian, far closer to the Spirit of Christ than some who do? Now this objection is in one sense very right, very charitable, very spiritual, very sensitive. It has every available quality except that of being useful. We simply cannot, without disaster, use language as these objectors want us to use it. I will try to make this clear by the history of another and very much less important word.
The word gentleman originally meant something recognizable, one who had a coat of arms and some landed property. When you called someone a gentleman, you were not paying him a compliment, but merely stating a fact. If you said he was not a gentleman, you were not insulting him, but giving information. There was no contradiction in saying that John was a liar and a gentleman, any more than there now is in saying that James is a fool and an M.A. But then there came people who said, rightly, charitably, spiritually, sensitively, so anything but usefully, but surely the important thing about a gentleman is not the coat of arms and the land, but the behavior. Surely he is the true gentleman who behaves as a gentleman should. Surely in that sense, Edward is far more truly a gentleman than John. They meant well. To be honorable and courteous and brave is, of course, a far better thing than to have a coat of arms. But it is not the same thing. Worse still, it is not a thing everyone will agree about. To call a man a gentleman in this new refined sense becomes, in fact, not a way of giving information about him, but a way of praising him. To deny that he is a gentleman becomes simply a way of insulting him. When a word ceases to be a term of description and becomes merely a term of praise, it no longer tells you facts about the object, it only tells you about the speaker's attitude to that object. A nice meal only means a meal the speaker likes. A gentleman, once it has been spiritualized and refined out of its old course, objective sense means hardly more than a man whom the speaker likes. As a result, gentleman is now a useless word. We had lots of terms of approval already, so it is not needed for that use. On the other hand, if anyone, say, in an historical work, wants to use it in its old sense, he cannot do so without explanations. It has been spoiled for that purpose.
Now, if once we allow people to start spiritualizing and refining, or as they might say, deepening the sense of the word Christian, it too will speedily become a useless word. In the first place, Christians themselves will never be able to apply it to anyone. It is not for us to say who in the deepest sense is or is not close to the Spirit of Christ. We do not see into men's hearts. We cannot judge, and are indeed forbidden to judge. It would be wicked arrogance for us to say that any man is or is not a Christian in this refined sense. And obviously a word which can never apply is not going to be a very useful word. As for the unbelievers, they will no doubt cheerfully use the word in the refined sense. It will become, in their mouths, simply a term of praise. In calling anyone a Christian, they will mean they think him a good man. But that way of using the word will be no enrichment of the language, for we already have the word good. Meanwhile, the word Christian will have been spoiled for any useful purpose it might have served.
Great.
Thanks.
We must therefore stick to the original, obvious meaning. The name Christians was first given at Antioch, Acts 11:26, to the disciples, to those who accepted the teaching of the apostles. There's no question of its being restricted to those who profited by that teaching as much as they should have. There's no question of it being extended to those who in some refined, spiritual, inward fashion were far closer to the Spirit of Christ than the less satisfactory of the disciples. The point is not a theological or moral one. It is only a question of using words so that we can all understand what is being said. When a man who accepts the Christian doctrine lives unworthily of it, it is much clearer to say he is a bad Christian than to say he is not a Christian.
I hope no reader will suppose that mere Christianity is here put forward as an alternative to the creeds of existing communions. As if a man could adopt its preference to
Congregationalism.
Yes. Or Greek Orthodoxy, or anything else. It is more like a hall out of which doors open into several rooms. If I can bring anyone into that hall, I shall have done what I attempted. But it is in the rooms, not in the hall, that there are fires and chairs and meals. The hall is a place to wait in, a place for which to try the various doors, not a place to live in. For that purpose, the worst of the rooms, whichever that may be, is, I think, preferable. It is true that some people may find they have to wait in the hall for a considerable time, while others feel certain almost at once which door they must knock at. I do not know why there's this difference, but I am sure God keeps no one waiting unless he sees that it is good for him to wait. That's kind of cool. When you do get into your room, you will find that the long wait has done you some kind of good, which you would not have had otherwise. But you must regard it as waiting, not as camping. You must keep on praying for light, and of course, even in the hall, you must begin trying to obey the rules which are common to the whole house. And above all, you must be asking which door is the true one. Not which pleases you best by its paint and paneling. In plain language, the question should never be, do I like that kind of service? But are these doctrines true? Is holiness here? Does my conscience move me towards this? Is my reluctance to knock at this door due to my pride or mere taste or my personal dislike of this particular doorkeeper?
Thanks. When you have reached your own room, be kind to those who have chosen different doors and to those who are still in the hall. If they are wrong, they need your prayers all the more. And if they are your enemies, then you are under orders to pray for them. That is one of the rules common to the whole house.
That's really cool.
Yeah. Did you perfectly count out how many paragraphs there were?
I did not. I'm not that prepared.
That was close.
Hey, so first off, I really like that preface. If there's any spots that you marked up or that came to you that you thought, man, I thought of this, or there's a question that's here,
there's certainly cans of worms which we can get into based off of this, as there will be kind of throughout the book. And so if there's any particularly that you think would be, you know, you would like to get into a bit more, we can absolutely do that. One of the things I thought was really cool was we were just visiting Jamie McLeod down in Mammoth. I think most of you guys probably know Jamie. He's like, him and his wife Natalie run the Lighthouse School of Supernatural Ministry down there. And it was really, it's really interesting because his brother, Tim, recently became Eastern Orthodox. And he's kind of, they're both from a kind of a pretty similar kind of charismatic like background. And it was interesting, like, the, you know, he's kind of been following along with him some. And Jamie was, he was talking to us about it. He was saying at first he took like a really analytical kind of perspective to stuff. And then he read through this preface. And he was saying this preface just rocked him to pieces.
Jamie.
And just in his whole approach to kind of thinking about the Eastern Orthodox and stuff. And how rather than having an approach of like being analytical towards a thing, it's like, you know, being analytical is okay. But primarily, like, our primary call, like, when it comes to believers in different denominations, it's primarily to, like, to pray for them. And so if we're going to have any kind of, like, you know, discussion about various beliefs or whatever, it has to be within the context of loving each other and praying for each other. It's like, that's the house rules. And if you think something is wrong, then the rule for you is that you have to pray for them, like, you know, all the more and try to love them all the more and not say, hey, I'm going to analyze you and kind of say, you know, kind of like, yeah, sort of like debate you down. It's just not, like, within the house of Christianity, that's not how things are meant to function. So, it was really cool. It was literally just a couple days ago he was telling us about how he got rocked by this section. It's really cool.
I really dug the part where it's talking about how, like, and, like, if someone's saying this person is Christian or not Christian, like, that's actually really useless to be talking about in this day and age. Where it's like, yeah, look, even the term Christian has been so diluted and so turned into, like, a good person or not.
Yeah.
And, like, now that doesn't really, like, so it's just kind of cool because, like, look, we're not even called to be talking about this. This
yeah.
isn't the topic that we're supposed to go down, like,
yeah.
whether someone's Christian or not. Because no one can judge a man's heart besides God.
Yeah, totally. And
thought that was cool.
And he totally grants the point on the other side as well, saying, look, you know, we're, like, it's God that searches hearts. So who has been the truest Christian in the sense of the heart and in the end? God can reveal that to us.
Yeah.
And he's the one that's going to reveal all those things at the end of days. But as far as the way that we actually have conversation, if we try to do that, like, we'll end up talking about nothing. The term will lose its meaning because we can't see in people's hearts like that. We can only take it to, say, somebody who identifies with these particular doctrines. So
I actually didn't read it that way. I didn't hear it, what you were talking about. I heard it as he was saying you don't want to dilute it into being a praise word. Like, you want it to be a word that actually does mean, like, you do believe in the doctrines. You
yeah.
do believe in that stuff. And to remain that way, like, you can talk about it that way, but it's like a pure fact thing. Not like, oh, I'm describing you as a person.
Yeah.
So that's what I interpreted.
No,
as,
and he's saying
that,
he's saying both of those points. So you're totally right.
I think it, like, with along that, that's how the word Christian is, like, today, like you're saying, of, like, dude, when somebody tells me that they're a Christian, I don't think, oh, like, they believe in, like, the doctrine. You know what I mean? Like, they believe what the Bible says to be true.
Yeah.
Like, usually what I think of is, like, they're trying to be a good person.
Or they go to church.
Yeah.
yeah
on Christmas and Easter.
Yeah.
Not, like, it being something that's factual.
Yeah.
Like, I am a follower.
Yeah. Yeah, totally.
I really enjoyed the hallway analogy and
yeah.
just kind of what he was saying about waiting.
Yeah.
God, you know, if you're waiting, he has something he wants you to learn and wait.
You should speak up so they can hear.
Basically, like, if you're waiting, if you're waiting for a calling or, that there's, God has a reason. And he has something for you to learn in waiting, as well as, you know, the analogy he also made with the doors and
Yeah. You know, some things may look, I don't know, for example, doing like missionary work, like that may look just awesome and like there's so much crazy things that happen. And so, you know, of course, someone may be drawn to that. And if you're not particularly feeling called to it, you know, maybe take a step back and like, okay, am I attracted to this because it looks awesome and yeah. I feel like crazy things will happen, or like I honestly feel like that's where God's leading me, and
yeah.
it's just yeah, not to speak anything bad about it, but just using that as
totally.
An example. Like,
did you guys catch the analogy how that worked with the rooms in the hallway? So if the whole house is Christianity, the hallway is just kind of like the, you know, the mere Christianity area, like the general place. And then each room, he kind of says, is like a denomination of Christianity. So you have like the Catholic room, the Orthodox room, the Methodist room, the Presbyterian room, the Charismatic meets on a floor in a living room. I don't know what he said.
Did I read that wrong then, maybe?
I don't know. I think that what he's saying is, I can tell you what I think he's saying. He's saying that
I think I might have
in
wrong.
The
no.
yeah I.
The thing is both.
Yeah,
it's
I think
both
it's things. Yeah, yeah. No, it's okay. He's saying that if you're in a place where you don't identify with a particular like denomination, we can use that term. So a particular like a particular expression of Christianity. If you're just like, I'm Christian, but I don't really know like what I am and like exactly what it means. So I don't know if I'm like, you know, maybe I'm going to be Eastern Orthodox, or maybe I'm going to be like Bethel meeting on a floor in a living room kind, or maybe I'm going to be a Presbyterian, or maybe I'm going to be an Anglican like Lewis was. If you don't necessarily identify with one of those things, like, yeah, that's okay. But he is actually encouraging to not just remain in the, yeah, I'm just kind of a Christian or another. He's saying that it's better to be within one of those rooms than it is to just kind of be like, oh, I'm just kind of a Christian, whatever. It's better to actually identify, because that's really where the meals happen. That's where God is serving us, and that's where God is feeding us, is through these various rooms, whatever it happens to be. So, and in that sense, I mean, you know, for myself, I guess to throw some testimony in there, like I'm a little bit guilty myself of being a hallway dweller, and not just like a hallway dweller, but like a guy who's just kind of been in all the rooms and just sort of like wander around the house, like, oh, look over here, there's a cool thing over here and so whatnot. And there's value to that. I think that there's value to knowing the things that are there and the things that are praiseworthy in the different rooms. But it also means that you don't necessarily have the same kind of commitment if you're a hallway dweller. And that's something where I think for anything in life, I think to understand the true value that's there, you have to have commitment. I don't think that there's another way to get that. I mean, I speak as one who's recently engaged, and so I have fairly, you know, strong feelings on it. But I really do think that's the case. I think that I think to just kind of like wander and float around, I think is, I don't think that you ultimately get everything that God wants for us just wandering and floating. And I know for myself, I'm definitely guilty of that in some ways. So,
I kind of feel that, like, I agree with you to an extent, but, like, I think why, like, C.S. Lewis might be saying, like, hey, it's better to be in a room, for those of you, for the people that are, like, new to Christianity and now they're in the hallway, like, how are you going to grow into your faith, not standing in a hallway?
Yeah.
But I think it's more about like, hey, hallway, sick, hallway's tight. But like, if you actually want to like live this out and learn and grow, then you need to enter a room.
Yeah.
So I think like the fact that you're a hallway dweller in the sense of I like checking out all the rooms. Like, wouldn't that mean you're just like learning in all the different perspectives?
I do think there's something to that. And I think as far as the faith goes in general, I think that learning all the different perspectives is absolutely something that you want to do. So regardless of your, regardless of the degree to which you're a hallway dweller or not a hallway dweller, like even if you are like you are one room and you really are fully persuaded, like if you are, man, I am Catholic and I am persuaded that being Catholic is the truth, it's the fullest expression of Christianity. Well, like good for you in one sense, but at the same time, you need to make sure that you're able to understand, insofar as you can, everybody else and why they are in the rooms that they're in. And you also need to make sure that you're praying for, you know, for all the people that are there. It's just the orientation of the heart that like that the Lord calls us to have. Yeah, I think I can follow you. I can follow you, you know, pretty well there. Yeah. Any other thoughts on the preface before we go to chapter one? Any other bits that jumped out to you guys? Sir?
I think going on with this ring thing, C.S. Lewis also was talking about, like, don't just go to a church service and be like, yeah, this service is really awesome.
Yeah.
Like, it's really
yeah.
He's like, no, you have to, like, qualify, is this holy? Is this the truth?
Yeah.
And I think that really ties into the room thing, because if you're in the hall, you don't really have, like, a standard of this is the truth. But if you're entering rooms, you're really developing.
Yeah.
It's kind of like your basis, your
yeah.
foundation.
Yeah. And I mean, I think what he says there is so helpful, and for me it's so convicting, because even just in saying that, it evokes in me this sort of passion where it's like, Lord, I want to know what the truth is. Like, truth is what I'm made for. I want to know whatever is true. And if there is varying degrees of truth, even if there's truth in all of these rooms, if there are varying degrees of truth within the rooms in the hallway, Lord, like, I want to know that, and I want to be shaped by the truth. I don't just want to be shaped by, hey, these are my tastes, and this is what I like the most. Lord, I want to be shaped by the truth, so give me eyes to see. Help me to understand this stuff. I think the way he says that is extremely, extremely important, because now more so than in Lewis's day, we, like, from a church perspective, we have churches which are designed now to meet every kind of taste. But if you look throughout history of the church, that has never been the case. It's emphatically never been the case, because when you do that, you sort of get an echo chamber. You sort of get a situation where the things that you say and the things that you like and the things that you want to do, you just end up surrounding yourself with people that have the same ideas and intentions and preferences and things like that. And you don't actually end up being challenged and formed and shaped in the way that God would have the full body of Christ being, you know, shaped and formed together. And so instead of getting the image of the body where you have the fingernail over here and the duodenum over here and the pancreas over here and the eyelash over here, and they're all functioning together and they're all together in one building and each church is functioning, you get a set of duodenums over here that are all doing, hey, we're team duodenum, we really like this is really what our preference is like, so everybody who likes duodenum things, we're going to have our own church.
I do not know what that is.
It's
part of the small intestine.
Yeah,
it's a part of the small intestine.
Who is this? And you get everybody who's feeling, who really likes eyebrows. I'm an eyebrow person. Oh, you like eyebrows too? Yeah, I'm also an eyebrow. Cool, we're gonna go over here and we're gonna do eyebrow things, and like, and then you'll split off of that. Well, we're the bushy eyebrows. We're gonna go over here. We're really not. We're kind of, you know, much more subtle, and we're gonna go over here and do our own subtle eyebrow thing. It's like from a church perspective, that is absolutely the direction that we've gone. It's absolutely what's happened, and I can't really see anything that's beneficial about that. We've commercialized it completely, such that unity or disunity doesn't make any sort of difference whatsoever. It's just kind of go whatever, follow your preference, go with what you like. It just has no correspondence with the church of history. It's not healthy for us. And so whatever our commitment ends up being, we've got to make sure that our commitment is based off of, Lord, I really think that this is true. And when I stand before you at the end of days, I can confess and say, Lord, I went with this because I thought it was true. Not because I liked it, not because not because it was the most convenient thing, but because I really thought this is the truth. And I think that wherever the truth is where you are. Might be able to guess, I feel a little strongly about this. I think what he's saying here is something that we need. So thank you for bringing that up.
Is he presenting then the solution is... Because I think, for me, my understanding of that is like when you're so convicted that yours is the truth, then it brings up, well, if I believe the truth and you don't believe what I believe, then I think what he talked about earlier, like Christians are so fond of talking about like what's the degree of our of our agreements or our disagreements, and that was like really interesting to me.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of what we're focused on is agreement. So if I believe the truth, I'm convicted by this truth, and you're not agreeing with me, then your truth isn't the real truth.
Yeah.
So is he presenting if it needs a solution, that prayer?
Yeah.
That we just need to pray. Because if we're going to be... for me, I just see like, okay, well, that's what I see is happening. Like, everyone's like, oh, that's good for you, and this is good for me, and that's your freedom, this is my freedom. Like, is that... I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, are you saying, like, what should we do, like personally ourselves, or what should we do, like, in relation to other people? I just want to make sure that answers what you're actually saying.
I don't know if I'm really I guess my question is that truth that we're being so convicted on, is he talking about the manifestations of that? And, like, going back to the agreement, when we pray for other people, like, what are we praying for? Like, oh, I want them to have the same revelation of truth as I do,
because
I'm so convinced that mine is the right one.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I think if you're really... Wow, my arm is bleeding.
Careful, bro.
If you're really persuaded that you have the truth, then I do think it is proper to pray, Lord, I think I have the truth here. And I ask for you to bring this other person to it. I think at the same time, you have to pray, Lord, I am fallible, and I get stuff wrong. And so, Lord, if I am wrong in this, or if I have seen a piece of the truth, and I am mistaking this piece of the truth for the whole truth, God, help me to see the pieces that I've missed here. Help me to see. And I mean, often I think when we're having conversations about rooms and kind of the hallway and the broader house, one of the things that I've really found is that within each denomination, there is often a piece of the truth which a certain group has grasped onto, that the Lord has given a special sort of kind of grace to. And there can be a tendency, so we can put this positively and negatively. Negatively, you can say that there can be a tendency to mistake that piece of the truth for the whole truth, and so it's such that it's not integrated into the rest of the truth of the faith, and it kind of becomes... And I mean, if we just, like, let's just take, like just like the charismatic movement, for instance. It's like, we've all here probably had really, really positive charismatic experiences, probably really, really negative charismatic experiences. And probably some of the really, really negative ones were for people that took charismatic experience as really, like, this is what the truth is. This is ultimately what's Christianity about. It's about charismatic experience. Like, screw everything else. Screw you guys if you're not down with it. It's about charismatic experience. Usually those are the ones where, like, the wheels go off pretty quickly. And the ones that I think do the best, I mean, look at Albert. He's a fantastic example of somebody who, he takes all the awesome stuff from the charismatic context, from the Pentecostal context, and then integrates it with the rest of, you know, with the rest of the house. And it's awesome. It's just dynamite. There's so few people that can do things the way that he can. So I think that we should be zealous for the things that we have and the things that are there. But we also have to say, Lord, there's a very good chance that there's other things that are true as well that I might not necessarily be seeing. So help me to have eyes to see that kind of stuff. Is there any other stuff, or do you guys want to go into the next one? I think the next one's a little bit shorter, but if there's any other bits from here that you guys thought were particularly interesting that you want to bounce around a little, we could do that too. I just love that practice. It's so helpful. Anybody else?
Law of human nature, baby.
All right. So yeah, let's jump over the foreword and let's go to this first bit. Live. Yeah. Live human nature. Well, do you want to start again?
Sure.
Okay.
Sure.
Okay, it's for you.
Christianity. The law of human nature.
Yeah.
Everyone has heard people quarreling. Sometimes it sounds funny and sometimes it sounds merely unpleasant. But however it sounds, I believe we can learn something very important from listening to the kind of things they say. They say things like, "How do you like it if anyone did the same thing to you?" "That's my seat. I was there first." "Leave him alone. He isn't doing you any harm." "Why should you shove in first?" "Give me a bit of your orange. I gave you a bit of mine." "Come on. You promised." People say things like that every day. Educated people as well as uneducated. And children as well as grown-ups.
Now what interests me about all of these remarks is the man who makes them is not merely saying that the other man's behavior does not happen to please him. He is appealing to some kind of standard of behavior which he expects the other man to know about. And the other man very solemnly, seldom replies, "To hell with your standard." Nearly always he tries to make out that what he's been doing does not really go against the standard, or that if it does, there is some special excuse. He pretends there is some special reason in this particular case why the person who took the seat first should not keep it, or that things were quite different when he was given the bit of orange, or that something has turned up which lets him off keeping his promise. It looks, in fact, very much as if both parties had in mind some kind of law or rule of fair play or decent behavior or morality or whatever you like to call it, about which they really agree. And they have. If they had not, they might, of course, fight like animals, but they could not quarrel in the human sense of the word. Quarreling means trying to show that the other man is in the wrong, and there would be no sense in trying to do that unless you and he had some sort of agreement as to what was right and wrong are, what right and wrong are, just as there would be no sense in saying that a footballer had committed a foul unless there were some agreement about the rules of football.
Now this law or rule about right and wrong used to be called the law of natures. Nowadays, when we talk about the laws of nature, we usually mean things like gravitation, or heredity, or the laws of chemistry. But when the older thinkers called the law of right and wrong the law of nature, they really meant the law of human nature. The idea that, just as all bodies are governed by the law of gravitation, and organisms by biological laws, so the creature called man also had his law. With this great difference, that a body could not choose whether to obey the law of gravitation or not, but a man could choose either to obey the law of human nature or disobey it.
We may put this in another way. Each man is at every moment subjected to several different sets of law, but there is only one of these which is free to disobey. As a body, he is subjected to gravitation and cannot disobey it. If you leave him unsupported in midair, he has no more choice about falling than a stone has. As an organism, he is subjected to various biological laws which cannot disobey any more than an animal can. That is, he can disobey these laws which he shares with other things. But the law which is peculiar to his human nature, the law he does not share with animals or vegetables or inorganic things, is the one he can disobey if he chooses.
This law was called the law of nature because people thought that everyone knew it by nature and did not need to be taught it. They did not mean, of course, that you might not find an individual here and there who did not know it, just as you find a few people who are colorblind or have no ear for a tune. But taking the race as a whole, they thought that the human idea of decent behavior was obvious to everyone. And I believe they were right. If they were not, then all the things we said about the war were nonsense. What was the sense in saying the enemy were in the wrong unless right is a real thing, which the Nazis at bottom knew all as well as we did and ought to have practiced? If they had had no notion of what we mean by right, then, though we might still have had to fight them, we could no more have blamed them for that than for the color of their hair.
I know that some people say the idea of law of nature or decent behavior known to all men is unsound, because different civilizations and different ages have had quite different moralities. But this is not true. There have been differences between their moralities, but these have never amounted to anything like a total difference. If anyone will take the trouble to compare the moral teaching of, say, the ancient Egyptians, Babylonians, Hindus, Chinese, Greeks, and Romans, what will really strike him will be how very like they are to each other and to their own. Some of the evidence for this I've put together in the appendix of another book called The Abolition of Man. But for our present purpose, I need only ask the reader to think what a totally different morality would mean. Think of a country where people were admired for running away in battle, or where a man felt proud of double-crossing all the people who have been kindest to him.
You might just as well try to imagine a country where two and two have made five. Men have differed as regards what people you ought to be unselfish to, whether it was only your own family or your fellow countrymen or everyone. But they have always agreed that you ought to not put yourself first. Selfishness has never been admired. Men have differed as to whether you should have one wife or four. But they have always agreed that you must not simply have any woman you like. But the most remarkable thing is this. Whenever you find a man who says he does not believe in a real right and wrong, you will find the same man going back on this a moment later. He may break his promise to you, but if you try breaking one to him, he'll be complaining, "It's not fair," before you can say, "Jack Robinson." A nation may say treaties don't matter, but then next minute they spoil their case by saying that the particular treaty they want to break was an unfair one. But if treaties do not matter, and if there is no such thing as right and wrong, in other words, if there is no law of nature, what is the difference between a fair treaty and an unfair one? Have they not let the cat out of the bag and shown that whatever they say, they really know the law of nature just like anyone else?
It seems, then, we are forced to believe in a real right and wrong. People may be sometimes mistaken about them, just as people sometimes get their sums wrong. But they are not a matter of mere taste and opinion any more than the multiplication table. Now, if we are agreed about that, I go on to my next point, which is this. None of us are really keeping the law of nature. If there are any exceptions among you, I apologize to them. They had much better read some other book. For nothing I am going to say concerns them. And now, turning to the ordinary human being who are left.
I hope you will not misunderstand what I am going to say. I am not preaching, and heaven knows I do not pretend to be better than anyone else. I am only trying to call attention to a fact. The fact that this year, or this month, or more likely this very day, we have failed to practice ourselves the kind of behavior we expect from other people. There may be all sorts of excuses for us. That time you were so unfair to the children was when you were very, very tired. That slight shady business about the money, the one you have almost forgotten, came when you were very hard up. And what you promised to do for an old so-and-so that you have never done. Well, you never would have promised if you had known how frightfully busy you were going to be. And as far for your behavior to your wife or husband or sister or brother, if I knew how irritating they could be, I would not wonder it at all. And who the dickens am I anyway? I am just the same. That is to say, I do not succeed in keeping a law of nature very well. And the moment anyone tells me I am not keeping it, there starts it up in my mind a string of excuses as long as your arm. The question at this moment is not whether they are good excuses. The point is that they are one more proof of how deeply, whether we like it or not, we believe in the law of nature. If we do not believe in decent behavior, why should we be so anxious to make excuses for not having behaved decently? The truth is, we believe in decency so much, we feel the rule of law pressing on us so, that we cannot bear to face the fact that we are breaking it, and consequently, we try to shift the responsibility. For you notice that it is only for our bad behavior that we find all these explanations. It is only in our bad temper that we put down to being tired or worried or hungry. We put our good temper down to ourselves.
These, then, are the two points I wanted to make. First, that human beings all over the earth have this curious idea that they ought to behave in a certain way and cannot really get rid of it. Secondly, that they do not, in fact, behave in that way. They know the law of nature. They break it. These two facts are the foundation of all clear thinking about ourselves and the universe we live in.
Dang. Jumping hammers.
Are there any thoughts or questions that came up immediately from that part?
It's cool.
I think it's brilliant.
I like
that there is essentially some basic form of human nature about right and wrong that like every human being knows, and like if you claim to not know it, it's kind of like, what the heck? Like,
yeah,
I don't think that's true, bro. It's, and people who try to, especially in this culture, I feel like the right and wrong is argued so much about like, yeah, there is kind of no right and wrong, but then like if they're mistreated, then it's clearly wrong. You know what I mean? So it's like, even just that small mistreatment, however it is, you can still agree that there is some type of right and wrong.
Totally.
And they know what they should do, you know, in situations. So it's kind of interesting.
Yeah. It's really funny. So this one spot here where he talks about whenever you find a man who says he does not believe in real right and wrong, you will find the same man going back on this a moment later. He may break his promise to you, but if you try breaking one to him, he'll be complaining, it's not fair, before you can say Jack Robinson. It's really interesting. I have an atheist friend named Tom, who I got to know through coaching the Harbor House kids playing hockey. And I just met him at the ice rink. He's an older guy, maybe like, I don't know, maybe like 45, something like that. And he's an atheist. And but he came up one day and he was just like, hey, you know, I'm an atheist, and I know that you're from some ministry thing, and I don't really like that kind of stuff, and I don't really, you know, I'm not like a religious person or whatever. But I really like what you're doing, and I just want to say, like, I think that's cool. I'm like, dude, awesome, man, that really encourages me. Thanks. And I just like got to know him like through that, and so we actually have a fair bit of correspondence, and we go back and forth a lot. And whenever I see him, he always wants to talk about religion. It's really interesting, which I just love. I mean, I learned tons from being able to chat with him, because it's just, I don't know. He's a thoughtful guy, and he's persuaded that there's no right and wrong, and he's persuaded that everything is just kind of evolutionary. Like, evolutionary stuff explains everything. What we're calling right and wrong is just a projection that we're making up, which is based off of what is, from an evolutionary standpoint, you know, most beneficial for the you know, for the preservation of the, you know, of the race or of the species or whatever it happens to be, and that there's no actual transcendent reality. That's there. It's all we're just making it up. And so any claim of right and wrong doesn't have any, you know, ultimately doesn't have any kind of validity. But he's also extraordinarily moralistic, which is just really, really, like, really fun, I guess is the best way to put it. And so, like, as an example,
And I mean, more, I guess moralistic in a positive sense, in that he really, really cares about right and wrong. But he also, if you like pin him down on it, he says, but it's all just made up and it doesn't have any actually like existence. It doesn't matter. But then as soon as you start talking again, he's really, really, really passionate about it. And so, for example, I sent him something from our reader up at Regent. There's this one reading about kind of like early Christianity and on like how the way that Christians in the first few centuries responded to diseases was one of the main things that resulted in the church growing, because the way that Christians responded to diseases, they put their lives on the line such that whoever actually survived the thing, so many of those people would become Christians, because they're the only people that would stay in the cities. They're the only people that would do this stuff. And so I sent him this reading, and he sent me an email back, which was fascinating, in that just all over the place, it had remarks about right, wrong, this is right, this is wrong, this wasn't, like, and sometimes it'd be, like, positive to the Christian, like, I guess this is a good thing, and yeah, I guess, you know, it's somewhat praiseworthy. But they said this over a thing, and that was so selfish, and this is really self-centered, the way they're saying it, and it's very self-serving how, like, this Christian leader said this thing over here, and, like, he really shouldn't have done that. It's just, like, it was just all over the place. I think it's fascinating. It's one of those things where we can't get away from it. There's just something that is ingrained in us, even if we have come up with other explanations besides that there actually being a real thing out there, like a real capital R right and a real capital W wrong. As many other explanations as we can try to come up with to get something like that, within like 2 seconds, as soon as the circumstance switches, and so as somebody, like as soon as somebody steals your car, then all of a sudden you jump back at it. Suddenly you're back on this same kind of ground. You're gonna get justice, whatever that is.
Yeah.
I think it's fascinating. We there's something ingrained within us that we can't get away from.
Okay, can I say something?
Yeah,
totally. It might actually be in the next chapter that they talk about it a little bit. I don't remember. But just kind of the fact that, like, you were saying that like your friend was saying, like, evolution, like it would just be like how things like just came about, like what was best for us. But if you think about it, like if that was true, like selfishness would be what was like, you'd like that would be what would kind of come about, because that's what's best for you, kind of, you know. It's just like thinking about yourself, like that's how we're gonna survive, that's how things are just gonna go if there's like kind of nothing there. But like if you think about like not being selfish, like that's totally the opposite, like than what is like actually gonna like help you out in the long run.
Totally. No, you're totally right.
Yeah, the evolutionary argument for that would say whatever is right for the preservation of a race or of a culture or of whatever, right?
Yeah.
So it's actually whatever is right in cultural perspective.
Yeah.
And that's kind of what they're referencing.
Yeah.
So, like, they're saying for the man himself, but also for the culture.
Yeah.
So that's why a man will sacrifice himself for someone else, because he's trying to make sure that the culture is preserved.
And it's interesting because, so do you guys know what the term like metaphysics means? So physics is, yeah, we were just talking about this. So physics is, this is the pen, and the pen drops at that rate, and that's because gravity does that. And so I'm gonna write you an equation, and that's gonna tell you why the pen's gonna drop with this. Metaphysics is, I wonder why that happens. Or like a question of like why, right and wrong, something like that. That's
speculatory science.
Yeah, something that isn't just the math. So basically, anything that really means something to us, anything that has any kind of meaning, is going to be metaphysics. Physics is going to be the math that's associated with it. And it's really interesting because even in talking to Tom, that the ideas of meaning and right and wrong that he has. Ultimately, even though he believes that in the end everything is nothing, he also says we just can't live like that. There's no way you can do it. And if you talk to him, because I've talked to him a bunch about like, you know, right and wrong and like why we should do certain things or shouldn't do other things, he often comes back to, well, we should do it for humanity. There's some kind of, you know, humanity, and that's the reason we should do it. But if you think about it, even humanity is a metaphysic. because if we're just dealing with plain old physics, I'm right here, Nick's over here. There is no broader category that unites us up in the sky somewhere called capital H humanity. There's nothing there. If you're just going plain old physics, I'm here, Nick's here, there's no relation to him, and me going and punching Nick in the face doesn't have anything to do with, you know, Bailey over here. There's no common capital H humanity that we're all participating in, that we're all drawing stuff from, that actually really matters. That's metaphysics. And so, like, if you want to assert something like that, you totally can, but you have to realize you're not going with just physics. You're not going with just just the facts on the ground, just give me the numbers. You're going with something larger. And it makes it such that, in having conversation with Tom, it's just really interesting. It's like anybody that wants to construct any kind of meaning or any kind of right and wrong or anything, you have to make recourse to some kind of metaphysics. You're never going to be able to just be like, show me the numbers, and that's what you know right and wrong is. There's always going to be something broader than that. And the varying conceptions of that, I mean, we're going to get to, and Lewis is like, this is maybe my favorite section, the first section here, although they're all my favorite sections. But he gets to the various conceptions as far as what really right and wrong is in the different religions. And those various conceptions are various. There's different things there. But there are, at their core, there's much more that unites them than what divides them, which I think is significant for what he says. And I think for, as Christians as well, I think it's definitely significant. So, any other bits that jumped out from this one? Any spots that weren't totally clear? I think this chapter is fairly self-explanatory, so I don't want to beat any dead horses. If there's any spots from the preface as well where you thought, this is really interesting, I'd like to look at this a little more, we can totally do that. I'm actually okay with, like, we're at a point where I would, like, I totally want to do more, because it's like, the more that he gets into, it's just really, really good. But I also think it's probably wise just to whet our appetite and not, like, try to take in too much so that we can dwell on the little pieces that we have, and so that everyone's going to want to show up next time, too.
Heck yeah, dude.
Yeah, I'd like to read it again.
Yeah. It's just so good. Are there any bits from that preface that step out?
Can we ask you questions next time, babe?
Totally, yeah. Cool. Totally. If there's any other stuff, we can start with questions next time. If there's any things that you guys were thinking about before we get into it.
Yeah, dude. That was awesome.
Yeah.
It's so... Yeah. Well, that's going to be the benefit, I think, to going through this stuff slowly as well, is that I think we'll be able to retain it a little bit if we just do two at a time.
Okay.
Anything else? Any other notes or questions you guys have?